What's up? Welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. I have Laura Jordan Baumbach, Chief Creative Officer of Mr. President, Aussie Done Good in the UK, co-founder of She Says, goes to Cannes, runs an event called Can't for people who cannot go to Cannes. Oh, you're so hectic and busy, you know, Laura. What don't you do?
I don't do a lot, but I'm not very good at sitting still, I think, is the thing. I'm not very good at just flopping on the couch, so.
Interesting. Well, speaking of flopping on the couch, what does a chief creative officer do? I just thought that was all one long couch job.
Mr. President's a pretty small agency, so I think that chief creative officer role changes. Like if you're in a massive agency, you're going to be doing, you know, much more of that kind of top level strategic stuff without doing hands-on work underneath, but I do everything. So literally I'm correcting copy or making, like, resizing JPEGs, as well as helping to run the business and setting that creative direction and foundation for the agency. Mm-hmm. I obviously look at all the work, but I've got an amazing team. So actually I'm not in there signing off every single piece of work. I've got an amazing partner as well, my ECD, John. So I kind of see myself a little bit, I guess, as that moral compass of the agency. So a lot of what we do and a lot of what we stand for, I guess, comes out of all of our values, but it's something I'm very passionate about, you know, around diversity and inclusion, around making sure that our workplace is accessible, making sure that our work is on point and that we are delivering a really positive message of change with the work that we do with our clients. So I do a lot of that stuff and a lot of hanging out with clients.
Okay. And then being the moral compass of the company, does that mean people are getting in trouble all the time?
No, but, you know, sometimes I can't get it right all the time, and neither can anyone else, you know. No, but I think it's just to be that kind of second head to look at stuff, to make sure it feels, sounds okay, and that we're doing as much as we can, you know, going there, encouraging our clients around casting choices, for example, or buying a more, like a braver script, whether that is braver in terms of the message it's saying or like braver in terms of the creativity.
So with the moral compass and with the creative philosophy or the creative direction of the agency, how much of that is explicit and written down and up on walls versus you operating from intuition?
You know what? That's an excellent question. It is a little bit of both, but we do have very clearly defined what we call a brand ethos, which we have written collaboratively, the four of us partners, which we all buy into, which we look at, you know, every time we do a work share, we sort of talk about how we're going in terms of delivering on that ethos. It's built into our job descriptions, it's built into our appraisals, and we do try to keep ourselves accountable to it, which is, you know, not only about this idea of the power of creativity to create change in the world, but then also we've got a lot of values around creative liberation. So actually how you free yourself from, I guess, that conventional straitjacket of agency world, you know, the layers and the process and the thousands of channels that you've got to pump rubbish out into and what have you. So we've got, you know, a bunch of strategies around those as well, which we care about a lot. Yeah, check ourselves against.
Just to anyone who's listening who runs an agency or who's in an agency experiencing some kind of existential turmoil, the idea of having a clear and explicit creative philosophy and then also strategy philosophy and then to connect that to job descriptions and appraisals, guess what? Not difficult.
It's not difficult at all.
But not common.
No. You know what? Because everyone knows this who has worked in an agency, the hardest bit to do is the bit that you're doing about yourself, whether that is, you know, sorting out all of that stuff or, you know, doing your website or, you know, redesigning your logo or whatever it happens to be, you always end up putting yourself last, which is sort of to the detriment then of the business, I think. It allows you so much freedom to have that kind of tight set of rules to play by.
Mm. But why do we put ourselves last? Why is it so hard? Why is the cobbler's shoes aren't great or the cobbler's kids' shoes aren't great? Why do we accept that? Because we don't accept it on behalf of other people. Maybe, you know, what's going on? Really?
Yeah, you know what? As far as I'm concerned, what's really going on is that short-termism and, you know, looking at the economics of the business in a completely roundabout way. So because the work that you do for yourself is, inverted commas, unpaid, it gets put to the bottom of the pile. It gets seen as a nice to have, you know, a piece of pro bono work for yourself rather than this is the thing that's going to make my business better and operate better. Yeah.
Well, and this is not to call anybody out directly, but when I've seen these projects start and then falter inside an agency, it's because the CEO wants to be the strategist and wants authorship, or there are consigliaries, second in commands, who want that, and they want that because they think that they're good at it, or they want the optics of having done it. And then also what comes into play is people don't want to sacrifice. They want to be able to say something vague and hope that it pleases people so that the doors stay open and they can just be everything to everyone, have like one client in every industry, all those old tropes. I think those things are the things that we don't talk about.
Yeah, and I think it's particularly difficult for these bigger businesses that have got layers of not only management within an agency, but then you've got multiple agencies around the world, and then you've got the, you know, the lead agency, and then you've got the holding company, and each of those layers has a different point of view. So previous agencies I've worked for that are much more part of that structure, you basically get given a usually like a really terrible line that means nothing that you then have to work through everything that you have, you know, with pretty dismal results, to be honest. So I think one of the lovely things about owning your own agency, and one of the reasons that we started it, was just to be master of our own destinies a little bit. And it's great to be able to sit down in a room and make a decision on something and go for it.
Mm-hmm. So going back to the connection that you have from creative direction or philosophy to job description to appraisal, is there a theme or a concept that appears in your written down creative direction that you can also spot in the job description and appraisal? Could you run me through how that does all connect?
Yeah, so we did basically a piece of work on ourselves that is the same piece of work that we do for a client, which is kind of discovering, you know, again, it's all terminology, but what we call a brand defining idea, it's our brand purpose. So that pulling that out of an understanding of what it is that we're actually good at and what it is that we actually want to do, turning that into a little bit of a kind of a manifesto and ethos. And then taking, sort of working through that to pull out a set of behaviors that align with everything. And those behaviors are the things that go into the job descriptions and what have you. So, and you know, we went through the same process as it would within the agency. So, you know, this collaborative, creative and strategic approach to get to that first bit. And then our sort of fab strategist actually taking that and turning that into a really tight set of behaviors and testing that. And then launching that to the agency.
Okay. And so an idea like collaboration, that's not a difficult thing to put on job descriptions. How do you put that in appraisals?
It's not a difficult thing to put on a job description, but it's also not very pointy, which is the point when you get to something like appraisals, have you collaborated? So, you know, I'm a great believer in having like a couple of extra words maybe to make it a little bit more sharp. So, you know, we don't necessarily say collaboration is actually part of one of our behaviors, which is that we all have each other's back. And then that is something that you're actually able to question people on. You know, if you are appraising someone, you're able to question the agency on, you know, when have they been able to support you, had your back, you know, worked with you to achieve the creative outcome. And that all gets fed back.
That's a good one. And I love that against the idea of, I feel like there's in the agency a lot of competition now where disciplines that used to be front office are now back office. And I love the thought of, you know, having each other's back versus stuffing each other in the back office.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think it's a really important one. Again, for like a small agency, the power comes from the collective, but it's very, very easy when something goes wrong to throw someone else under the bus. It's just human nature in a way. So it's something that you really need to, I won't say like mark against, but it's something that you really need to encourage.
In the bigger places in which you've worked, how would you oversee work? You know, you mentioned that a CCO, one of their main jobs is to oversee work. And in at Mr. President, if it's a bit smaller, then that's going to be, obviously, that's going to look very different to being in a big place. So in a bigger place, what does that look like?
Yeah, so I guess, for example, when I was ECD at LBI, which is now Publicis Media by way of Digitas, as all of these like messy mergers. So when I was there, I think the creative team, including design, what have you, was around about 100 people, 90 people, 100 people. And I shared the role with Simon Gill, who's a fab human being. So number one, we split the clients in two. So we didn't actually work as a team, but we split the clients in two, which helped to reduced the amount of work that we had. And then we had a set of, I guess, probably about 10 creative directors. And so they would, I like giving people a lot of autonomy. I like, you know, the way that I like to lead is by supporting people so that they feel comfortable to fail, but allowing them to make their own decisions rather than that kind of top-down way of being a leader, I guess, that more authoritative way. So, you know, I would give them quite a lot of autonomy, but I would do a lot of check-ins and do a lot of one-on-one workshops or sort of group workshops with them on the work that was happening to make sure it's as good as it can be. So I was kind of over all of the work. I saw it all, but I wasn't, I didn't have to sign off every single little thing day to day.
Right. Was it on them to bring you work, or was it part of every single project process that there were key check-ins with you?
Yeah, there were key check-ins. It's totally up to them, but, you know, to make it easy, we also had, you know, weekly formal check-ins that happened with everyone. And if a project was in full swing or, you know, nearing completion, or there was an issue with it, then obviously I would spend more time on that project with the creative director trying to solve those problems, but not solving them myself, trying to work with them to solve the mm-hmm. issues.
Okay. From what I understand about people who are good at what they do, as in world uh-huh. class, they tend to work from a small set of rules of thumb. Uh-huh. But because of their expertise, their skills, and their experience, they're able to apply those rules of thumb in very specific and assertive ways to get to good work. Uh-huh. When you're overseeing work, what questions are you asking yourself about the work?
Okay, again, that's a really interesting question. I mean, the first one is, what is this nugget? So what's the nugget that we loved at the beginning of the project, and where is it, and is it still alive? And if my job can be to make sure that that little kernel or cart or whatever you want to call it of the project is the thing that everyone knows that we have to protect, then the chances of that work going through and being successful is much, much greater. So it's you know, being really specific about what's that thing that needs protecting. It sounds like a very obvious thing, but something I've learned from experience. I was never very good at kind of speaking up when I thought I saw an issue. And then when it came back to bite me, obviously, if you're in a leadership position, it's your problem. So I will voice very much from my gut what I'm feeling about the work, even if I can't quite explain why yet. And it just gives us a chance to stop and have a discussion about it. And then I guess I'm kind of looking for clarity, because particularly, you know, I come from a digital background where concepts are incredibly complicated, but there has to be some kind of simplicity and some kind of story in there that is easy to tell. So again, that's the thing I'm trying to focus on mm-hmm, and make mm-hmm. clear and make sure it comes through at the other end, so it doesn't get lost in 1,001 different executions. Okay. Yeah, all the other stuff other people are really great at doing. So
okay. So I want to ask you questions about those three things. First of all, yeah. Protecting your nugs, mm-hmm. taking care of your kernels, little kernel care. Yeah. Can you think of a project where the nugget was getting squashed and you had to protect it?
Yeah, 100%, actually. I mean, it always gets squashed in some way, right? But I think I did a project, it was quite a long time ago, actually, it was pre-Mr. President, and it was for Macmillan Cancer Support. And they came to us when I was at LBI asking, it was a very small brief, it was like a 10 grand brief, to build like an automatic emailer that, you know, you put in your address and it would email your MP on behalf of cancer patients to lobby them around fuel poverty. Because in the UK, if you've got cancer, you're not eligible, well, you weren't eligible for any subsidies. And it's, you know, just at that time when you perhaps lose your job and also you're at home a lot more and you often feel the cold a lot more. So we were lobbying around fuel poverty for cancer patients, and we went back to the client and said, no one, like MPs just don't read those letters. Let us do something else. We want to do something incredibly sort of creative, but something that we weren't really sure that was going to work, which is creating this. We created what we called the Infinite. It's a knitted woolly petition machine, live streamed on the web, so you could upload your support and sign this petition to go to number 10. It would knit you a unique pattern in this enormously long scarf that ended up being longer than Big Ben. That scarf would be delivered to number 10. All of those petitions were signed in the same way, but it was a creative way to accomplish the same means. but it was massively ambitious. And as I said, we had no idea how we were going to build it. As the team, well, I guess as the leader of the team, I needed to make sure that, number one, everyone was super enthused about building it and didn't lose heart as we came across obstacles, but also protect them from the rest of the agency who, you know, for them, it's an easy 10 grand to make a automatic lesser maker. And that really, for me, in terms of having that pivotal role of like protecting the team, protecting this nugget of the idea, making sure that it got delivered properly, making sure that, you know, when we got towards those hurdles sort of halfway through, three quarters of the way through, it wasn't killed and we managed to, you know, deliver it. And then making sure that it was supported properly for the 3 months it was running with enthusiasm. That was, you know, a challenge. It was, you know, much more about negotiation and, I guess, and teamwork and sort of creating a really good, fluid energy around the team than it was the creative idea. You know, I didn't have really very much to do with the creative idea at all. That was my amazing team.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, on behalf of all Nuggets, thank you. Now, the second point you said was about speaking up and trying to call out issues. Now, someone in a position of power as an ECD or a CCO, people do look to you for what you think. However, not all people in positions of power and authority are very self-aware. And I've certainly walked around a lot of agencies. I get around and I see lots of things. And, you know, I've seen global chief creative officers kind of berating people for an hour and a half on a pitch. And gender's not that important to that particular story, but it wasn't the gender that you'd associate that behavior with. And I looked at it as I walked past an hour and a half later. I'm like, that's still going? That's horrible. Yeah. Like, who's going to want to work for that person?
Yeah.
And also now they're going to have to work back. So how do you calibrate on that ability, that power that people are listening and waiting for you in a way? There's a beautiful phrase I heard once that when a CCO whispers, it's like a lion roaring. So how can you express everything intuitively and in a carefree way, knowing that it's like a lion roaring?
Yeah. Look, this is something that I have had to learn because coming from Oz to the UK, this is the big like challenge that I had. You know, you think you go from Australia to the UK and the culture's the same and everything's going to be the same. But yeah, I was used to working in a studio where if I'd done something and it wasn't right, my creative director would come over and in a friendly way that wouldn't offend me, we'd go, oh, look, mate, that just looks a little bit like shit. Can you do it again? Mm-hmm. I'd go, yeah, sure, I'll do it again. And not taking any offense and not taking it personally and knowing it was about the work. That behavior does not translate to the UK. And so sort of when I first moved over here, I then didn't speak up at all. And then, as I said, when projects went wrong and they landed on me and I went, oh, I saw that right at the beginning and I didn't say anything. I think when you're a CCO or when you're in any of those roles, a creative director or, you know, what have you, your ability to communicate is your most important tool, whether that is communicating to the team, listening, you know, and to, you know, to listen and to speak, you know, to understand why something's been done the way it's been, to have a conversation around that, to make sure that, you know, you get to a right result, to stop something quickly enough if it's not right. These are all skills that you really have to learn. And then, you know, the converse side of that is you also need to learn how to sell. And that, again, means you need to understand different people, what motivates them, what makes them get out of bed, you know, what is going to get them to the great work, how much help do they need, how much help do they not need. All of that is, it's understanding your team, but it's a skill around communication, I guess, and negotiation that you have to learn on the job.
Mm. Yeah, and it happens within the culture. I mean, I've sat at the top of a particularly well-known skyscraper in New York. I was taken to a meeting with an agency that I'd not grown up in. And we're sitting up there. There were 10 people or so in this room and everyone was just firing off sentences after other people spoke. And I had no idea what anyone was talking about. It wasn't English. And so I raised my hand about 40 minutes in and I said something that was, I guess, what I shouldn't have done this, but I was like, I'm not following this conversation. Can we please work out exactly what we're saying, what problem we're trying to solve? And I was trying to kind of corral the conversation. And I was like, I should not have done that. That's not what you do in America.
Yeah.
But I couldn't, no, I'm sitting there like, I'm not stupid, but if I'm sitting there in a conversation for a long period of time with important people and I'm not following it, like, come on.
You've got to ask.
But culture.
I think, Yeah, culture. And what you learn is in a meeting like that, absolutely, if you don't understand something, ask. You only need to, if you're in a meeting, you only need to say the one thing, but like even before you go into the meeting, like what's the one thing that you want everyone to take away from what it is that you've said?
Yeah.
And you literally only need to say that one thing. And the rest of the time you can kind of be listening to people and, you know, sort of, I think that's quite a good trick as well, rather than, not if you don't understand stuff, but I think, you know, often you go into meetings and you see people who are so eager to impress that they just will keep sprouting stuff.
Yeah.
Or, talk about stuff that's not relevant, what have you.
But in parts of the world, that like in parts of America, not all of America, you have to do that because it's seen as confidence and whether or not there's competence there, but if it's, you know, confidence sells, then people want to see you doing that at other people if they're your boss as well.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? I think culture plays so much a part of it and it's enormously underestimated how different cultures are around the world that feel very similar.
Can you think of an example of a time you didn't speak up where you would now?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, particularly in my early career in the UK. So, and I won't go into particular projects that probably don't even exist anymore.
I just
don't think they even exist anymore.
Okay.
You know, it was a long time ago. I'm not old. But, you know, when I was first leading design projects at an agency called Lateral, which is a brilliant agency, which again doesn't exist anymore, but it's an amazing place. That there were quite a few times there where I really should have said something and didn't, and then it came back to bite me, and I was like, oh. So that was a big,
like
big
what
learning for me.
Like, about what though?
Oh, just design looks like shit. Project's not going to work. I think there might be an issue with the client because I picked up some vibe, but I don't know whether it's right, so I'm not going to say. You know, any and all of those things.
Okay.
And it was probably partly my design as well.
All right.
In fact.
Okay, so there are three aspects to the overseeing role of CCO: protecting nuggets, speaking up, and then you talked about clarity and simplicity.
Yeah.
That clarity is like one thing that so many strategists talk about and they yearn for it. They're not sure if they have it. They're not sure if they're ever clear. Can they ever be clear? But with the work that you do, what are the questions that you pose to yourself to work out whether there is clarity, whether there is enough simplicity?
Yeah. I mean, it sounds a bit weird, but the first one I have is emotional. Like, what do I feel? Do I strongly feel a thing or do I feel conflicted? Because I think sometimes even if you can't get clarity in like language or what have you, there should always be a clarity of like emotion or direction in a piece of work. So that's number one. Then the second one is, again, particularly with these complex projects, is everything laddering up to that bit where strategy and creative meet. So has the strategy like flexed to work with the creative? Is the creative saying the right things about the strategy? And then is that working the whole way through everything? So, you know, when you're doing a standard ad campaign, it's quite simple because, you know, it's a campaign and you might have a line and you've got a visual style and a set of assets or what have you. When you're doing something which is creating a new behavior for a brand for the next 3 years or something like that, it gets really complicated really quickly. So it's being very, very brutal with what is part of that story and what's really needed and what's not needed. You know, we're lucky, again, at Mr. P, we've got some really interesting strategists who are really great. They kind of come more from the, like, the media channel planning kind of side of things, and they are immensely helpful just cutting out the crap from that side as well, so that you're not delivering 1,000 different pieces of work when you need to do one or three or what have you. So there's that side of it. Just make sure, you know, the messaging and the tone of voice is clear, and everyone, particularly because we work in an enormously collaborative way at Mr. P, so you'll have, rather than teams, you sometimes have teams competing with each other, but often than not, because you've got a small team, everyone will have a say in the work, and then my job is often to meld multiple different creative opinions into one opinion and then give that clarity there. And it's, you know, everyone has their favorite thing that they want to hold on to. So it's about going back to the first one, setting what that nugget is that everyone can follow rather than everyone having their own little idea about what's important.
All right. Got to get clear on your nugs, and then you got to protect them and speak up for them.
What are, and
this is not to get you to condemn any specific individual or even the role, but what are three common missteps that you see senior creative people taking as they move up the ranks?
not being able to let go of work, which, you know, you have to do, again, depending on the size of the agency, sometimes you've still got to have your hands in. But I think when you can't let go of the work, you suffocate the people underneath you and you don't allow them to grow. And if you don't allow them to grow, then the most ambitious, talented, interesting people will leave. So it's like hands off the work. You know, you can, as I said, support, clarify, direct in some way, like point them in the right direction. But you can't come in and change all this stuff at the last minute and present it, because that's, you know, no one likes that to happen to them. So I think that is a massive one. And I think a lot of the time, senior creative people aren't, you know, we're not trained in how to manage people. So it can be really, really tough. And I think that moves into, you know, that broader piece around making sure people are managed properly, understanding that things like appraisals and going and have a cup of coffee with someone is as important as making sure the work is great, because you need to sort of nourish the individuals in your care and give them the environment for success. And not expect everyone to be like you. I think about that all the time, because, you know, when I was going through as a junior, you know, you probably spent years just resizing stuff before you were even allowed to touch a campaign. And now people expect to move faster. The landscape is different. There are more channels, all of that kind of stuff. And you need to be able to adapt to that and not go, well, when I was starting out, I didn't get that opportunity, so you can't either. It's about understanding what makes people stay motivated, I guess.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, they're probably the two main ones.
Okay, we'll go with two.
Yeah.
Three's a magic number, but two's pretty good.
I know.
Do you hear many stories about senior creative people stealing work from their juniors? Like, it's never happened to me. I've heard stories of CCOs in Australia doing this from interns or from those, you know, summer programs, but I haven't heard it in a big way. But recently I'm getting stories from strategy folk in England, and not just England, where, you know, they've done a bunch of research, they've come up with some ideas, and then their name disappears from the presentation and their boss presents it when they're not even in the room and they don't even hear about it. Is this common in the creative department?
Yeah, I think it's more common than what you would expect. And I don't think it's necessarily done in a malicious way. I think it's just this kind of old school view of what it is to be a creative director, which is my name's on the work and I'm the one in charge. And it's me rather than I'm the director of an amazing team. And it's them. You know, I always see myself, the most exciting briefs I would rather give to my team to work on and me help support. And I do all the, you know, All the dull stuff in a way. I won't say it's dull stuff because it's not dull stuff, but, you know, my job is actually to do the hard slog because that's what I'm paid for. Their job, because they're young and they're fresh and they're exciting, is to come up with these brilliant ideas, and then together we turn them into something great. But yeah, you see it a lot, I would say.
Just like still?
Yeah. Yeah, I think still. I mean, of course it's changing, but I think, yeah. I think it still happens. I didn't actually go into any of the awards in Cannes. I'd be interested to see like who picked up the awards and had the name on the trophies compared to who did the work. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, like some of the famous campaigns from the past few years ago, you hear the stories about them and it's two or three people, but the entries have like 50 names on them. And you know what? They don't usually have the strategist's name on them if the strategist...
I mean, the other thing like I'm really keen on is, you know, you've got to put everyone's name on there, even if they're a freelancer, but they've really contributed, or an intern. It's super important to like make sure that their name is on stuff. That's something that I, you know, learnt by not pushing to have my name on stuff when I was kind of starting out, and then having to go back in retrospect and ask my old bosses to put my name on the work, so that, you know, when I was working with DNAD and before I was DNAD president, when they asked me to sit for the board, that you've done work that's won awards. I'm like, yes, I have. And then when you look, and my name wasn't on it, and that's nothing to do with my company because they were great. It's just that I didn't push because I thought I'm only head of art and I'm just, you know, running the department and checking everything over. I'm not actually doing the design work. I didn't push for it, and I had to go back and fix it all. So it's super important to put people's name on their work.
What's the point of awards anymore?
It's a good question. I mean, I guess they still serve as a bit of a beacon to where marketing can go. I think in a lot of cases, awards is very disconnected to what the great piece of advertising is. I've made a lot of stuff that I'm super proud of and has had a huge impact, which is there'd be no way it would win an award. It's just not an award kind of a thing. And I guess it's an interesting I don't know, measure of where we are as an industry. Again, looking at all the Cannes Awards, it was interesting to see what was winning and what wasn't, and what that said about the direction that maybe clients are going in, or that creatives want to go in. But yet they're very disconnected things.
So let's talk about that. Like, what are some of the unspoken dynamics in judging, such as the two that you just mentioned? Well, one of them especially, which is the direction that creatives want to go in, because there were a lot of creatives who've grown up doing ads a few years ago, judging work that was not ads.
Yeah.
And part of that I see is, you know, first of all, they might just be amazing conceptual thinkers, but also there's a need to extend one's career. And, you know, like, what are some of the unspoken things that happen in judging? Do people just have favorite agencies? Do they need to have seen the campaign before? Do they
negotiate? I have never seen it, but I know anecdotally there's a lot of that negotiation and favorite agencies and favoring other agencies and network stuff that goes on. But I've not seen it, so I can't really comment on that. I think it super helps that people have seen it before. It really, really helps, because if you're seeing a piece of work and you've never heard of it before, there's always the question, like, well, how big really was it and how much of an impact did it really make? Even though you're not really supposed to be thinking about impact or what have you for most of the awards. It's, you know, purely about the creative idea and the craft. But, you know, I think that's probably quite a big one. I think things that are culturally difficult to understand or come from a place that is very, very much of one culture don't tend to do as well. Mm. Obviously, case videos mean a lot, and there's a whole art to them. And I do know that some agencies employ people full-time to make those videos and they do a really good job, and then others can't afford to or don't, and they really struggle. And of course, you know, it's a David and Goliath out there. So, you know, we don't tend to enter a lot of stuff into awards, because we could maybe enter one piece of work into each award for the course of the year, and that's our entire budget. You know, and I'd rather maybe spend that money on a really interesting pro bono project or what have you. So we don't do it that often.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, you have other agencies where the CCOs are, they're bonused on how many awards they pull in. Mm. And that creates an entirely different kind of environment and set of work.
Yes, it certainly does. So as far as starting Mr. President, why even do that?
You know what? Because I was working in a brilliantly creative agency, going through difficult times, having an absolutely miserable time, realizing that the writing was on the wall for digital work in particular, and that everything that we were doing could be pretty much replaced by robots. Having to be subservient to big creative ideas, which still, after all these years, weren't really ideas, they were just ads. You know, so that classic thing of, can you take the TV ad and turn it into something digital? And but there's no idea in it. It's a great story, but I can't tell that story in a banner. So what do I do? And I was just kind of sick of having to struggle with that. And I went, you know, for all the things that digital is, like, number one, we understand audiences better than anyone else, because that is our job, to remove friction, to get under the skin of people. You know, there is still a practice of primary research in digital agencies that doesn't happen in traditional agencies. You know, it's a really interesting place. When I was at LBI, you know, we had anthropologists there who would go out and actually discover things for us in that way. So I think there's, you know, there are all these skills there. There's skills about knitting together really complicated things and making them simple. There are, you know, there's a ton of stuff there, which if it was released into working on developing a brand, I won't even say marketing, but like released onto creatively growing and extending a brand or fixing a massive problem in a brand, is super exciting. But you're just not usually given the space to be able to do it, because you're put in a digital box, or it's changed a lot in the 7 years since we've had Mr. P, you know, a digital box or a above the line box or a CRM box or what have you. So the idea of us starting the agency was to kind of take all the amazing stuff we knew from digital and put it across the entire landscape. And actually, we started as a strategic consultancy, working with brands to help them transform themselves internally to be able to do more interesting work that was more beneficial for now rather than for in the 90s.
Mm.
Yeah, so it was that, really. It's like the world needs to transform. It's taking too long. Clients need help because there's another platform every day. So they need some strategic guidance. They need some guidance about what kind of creative works. They need some guidance about their audiences. They need some great creative work that works in those spaces. And if you can come up with that wonderful idea that lives outside of all of those assets, I guess you would call them, then you've got an amazing idea that you can take into, you know, if you're doing custom service, you've got an idea and a set of behaviors that they can use when they're on their phone. You've got a set of behaviors you can use when you're doing a UX for your website. You've got a great story that you can tell in content. You've got your ad, and it all fits together in one nice ecosystem. And that's kind of what we set out to do, really.
Okay, okay. And I would completely understand if you need to be delicate in your answer to this next question.
Yeah.
What's your attitude towards scale and size? Do you want to be big? Do you want to have offices everywhere? Do you want to sell? Or is this like, you know what, this is the next decade or two. It's life's work. I'm good.
Well, you know what? What we have done, and we've done three now, so we've been like 30, 35 people for the last couple of years, and it's a really nice size. And I've been at two previous agencies that have been at that size at one point, or, you know, for a long period of time. It's a really great size because you get to trust and understand everything about everyone that you're working with, you know, very deeply. And that's awesome. What we've done is, instead of kind of expanding and creating another Mr. President office, we create new businesses that kind of sit alongside us. So we have a strategic consultancy called White House. We've got a design agency or design studio called Oval. And we've got a creative tech agency in Sweden called First Lady. And they're all, you know, we're all from the office of Mr. President. We're all part of family. Some are fully owned, some are minority owned, what have you. And all of them have really been set up by staff present or past, so they understand our culture, who we love, who have these particular skills, and so we, you know, want to continue working together on whatever basis. And so that's kind of the way that we grow. I think that's the way that we want to continue growing. I don't think we'll ever, I never want to be, you know, in a situation where I see someone in the office and I don't know who they are.
I love that. I didn't know that you were doing all that. That's amazing. And because that size 30 to 35, they're probably conferences and or industry organization get-togethers every year talking to people who run small agencies. And they hit that 30 to 35 and then they want to get to 50. And there's just this bump because you have to bring in, from what I understand, sometimes you have to bring in excessive administrative help. And that can swing the culture a little bit. And also it's harder to turn down pitches. And that can change the work you do, which can change the culture that you have.
Yeah.
Are they things that you've been quite aware of?
Yeah, and things that we've been aware of. I've gone through two enormous, you know, agencies that have had enormous growth like that. So kind of experienced from the 20 to the 250s a couple of times and kind of seen what it does to the agency and had some idea about how to navigate it, but we've not necessarily always done the right thing either. What we do have is that us as a leadership team are really tight. So we talk a lot and we challenge each other a lot and we ask a lot of questions of each other. And that's seen us through, you know, like good times where we have expanded to 50 people actually because we've suddenly a client of ours has grown so much to, you know, having to get over hurdles like losing a client worth, I hate to say it, somewhere between like 60 and 70% of the business overnight and being able to kind of keep ourselves together and work out a way of hanging on to our amazing people who, you know, they're the things that count. So it's the relationship that we have, which is the thing that has sustained us, I think.
I think a lot of people would love to set up their own company. They're not sure whether to bring someone in, how to find people that they relate to, how to find people that would be complimentary. It seems like a complete crapshoot. How do you work out who you're compatible with?
That's really tough. So Nick and Claire had worked with each other for 10 years, that there was no problem. I took a punt on them and they took a punt on me, to be honest, when we joined forces, but it just felt right. And I guess I have that personality that I will throw myself into something and I'm not that afraid of fucking it up. So we went for it. I just really liked them as people. And I think that's the key thing. And I thought Claire was she's the CEO. She's the most brilliant person I've ever met at getting people to do something that she's asked them to do whilst them thinking that they've decided to do it themselves. So she's incredible. She has this magic power and she's so calm, which is really, really wonderful. And then Nick is, I just absolutely love him because he's the most intelligent, most creative, grumpiest, like strategist. Like he just blows me away. He's he's brilliant, and I just really loved kind of meeting him, and then also kind of seeing his passion. And John, our fourth partner as well, is just, he's just incredibly passionate, and he's been working with us right from the very beginning. So I guess we have all got to know each other in different ways, but and it's not always been easy. But what it's meant that when we have had those bad times, often there's like one of us having a really bad time and the other ones are okay. So we're able to kind of lean on each other a little bit. And we have had some tough times, and it's really important, I think, to have people there that you can open up to during tough times. It doesn't matter how good they are, but more importantly, can you come together as one unit when everything's against you, or are you going to turn on each other? I think as long as you feel like you can stand by each other, that's the main thing.
Okay. In some respects, I can't believe that I've left She Says till the end, and yeah. I feel guilty about that, but also I do think this is a 6-hour interview that we're doing in an hour.
Yeah.
Let's chat, She Says. When did you start it and why?
Yeah, so Ali, Larry, you and I started it in 2012. No, 2007. I was pregnant at the time. We were both kind of heads of like department/creative directors of our agencies, and we got to know each other because we were always the only two women on panels in London in terms of like digital advertising and design. So we'd be like, oh, hi, woman. Hi, other woman. Every single time. And then we got to chatting, and we also were part of this group called Creative Social, which was brilliant, which brought creative directors together. And we thought, like, what's the problem with the industry? Because I had a department of 35 people. She was running a department at her place. There were no women, but we weren't seeing any female CVs. So I was desperate to hire some women into the agency, and no one applied. And when you look at whatever it is, over 50% of people doing art design advertising courses are women. And then you don't see any, even at that junior level, applying for your agency. You think, like, where the fuck have they gone? And what are they doing? And how can we help to change this rather than just talk about it? So we came with this idea, She Says, which was at first just a meeting to talk about what we can do to change the ratio. And what we found is that conversation, there was a lot of power in that conversation and that network. And so we continued the conversation, continued this networking, and it just took off. It had a life of its own. And suddenly all of these women from all over London at first came out of the woodwork, all supporting one another, all, you know, so we were doing monthly events, never talking about the issues about women in the industry after that first one, really, but helping to train women to go into the workforce and be like more confident, and know more about trends, understand design more, know how to run a brainstorm, all of those kinds of things that they might be too nervous to ask. Mm-hmm. So we did a lot of that, and had a lot of supporting students into the industry. And then as those students have moved through the industry over the last 12 years, I guess we've started to do a whole bunch of other stuff. So we now do mentoring, which is still doing monthly events. We do awards. We do large-scale events. We do events for senior women. We give platforms for senior women to talk about their work, not just about being a woman, so that, you know, it's super important for these jobs like mine, I guess, like these kind of ECD, CCO jobs, that you've got a profile for your work and for yourself, because otherwise you're just not going to get one. So, you know, sort of helping to create those platforms for women. And we partner with a lot of other women's groups that are now kind of popping up, which is great. But we can never really tell, because it's all run by volunteers and we're all over the world. So, you know, we're in Dubai, we're in Abu Dhabi, we're in possibly Afghanistan this year, possibly, you know, we're in Scandies, we're all around the UK, we're all around North and South America. We've got a small group in India, we're in Oz, all up the East Coast. I don't think we've got anything in Perth. And we're opening up in New Zealand and, you know, sort of keep growing. We've got a couple of places in Europe. So, but it's all run by amazing women who volunteer, who work towards a set of principles, and we share things between the women that run these groups around the world. I think we're probably 23 countries or so in about 40 cities, something like that. And everyone runs it in a different way. So, you know, in London, it's a monthly event. In Amsterdam, they do 4 events a year, but they do enormous events with like 500 people coming along to it. You know, in the States, it's ticking along really, really well. And there's that culture there of that sort of work culture, and the networking culture there is really, really strong. Mm-hmm. In other places, it's kind of more about the work, or it's more broadly about creativity. So you know, some places in Europe that are quite small, sort of very inclusive in terms of bringing in, I guess, non-commercial creativity into what they do. So it's kind of flexible, but it works. We've got 40,000 members around the world, which is amazing. By members, I mean people on our email list, because you don't have to pay at the moment. You don't have to pay to access, she says, and that's always been super important for us, you know, particularly for students and young people. And I guess watch this space over the next 12 months, because we are looking at how to turn it from something that's in essence philanthropic to something that can support itself a little bit more in terms of growth. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some places that we really want to be in. You know, we're massive in Singapore, for example, but would love to set up in Japan or Korea, and they're more challenging markets. So, yeah.
Okay. Two questions about the types of conversations that are happening within She Says right now. Mm-hmm. Are there conversations that you're still having in 2019 that blow you away because you're still having them?
Yeah, so many. And this is the thing, you know, when you hear or read people, often like older white guys, but not exclusively, saying, I'm sick of the diversity inclusion thing, like I'm sick of talking about diversity, can we just shut up now? Or, oh, like, can we just give up on Me Too? These things haven't changed for centuries for reasons, because they're really endemic and they're really difficult to change. And that there are 1,001 small things that need changing in order to change the way that women are seen in relation to men and their power in relation to men and the confidence that you're brought up with from day dot as a woman as compared to a man and your compliancy and the misogyny that you experience in the industry and sort of all of that holds you back. So it's a long old slog, but it's definitely worth it. But yes, like every conversation still happens too much. You know, sexual harassment still happens too much. People being held back and told they're not leadership material because they lead in that more kind of shepherding way rather than the top-down screaming at you way. That happens all the time. Women being stuck on women's briefs, women not being given opportunity to pitch because you don't want to pitch because you might, you know, be away from your family too much and that'll upset you, so we won't give you that cool pitch. We'll put you on a 9-to-5 when you've not asked for it. Or, you know, flexible working still not happening for those that do want it, and propositioning young creatives by older creative men. It's all still going on. But all we can do is to build that strength in the collective, I guess.
And then are there conversations that are happening now that you think are way more clear-headed and way more constructive than they were a few years ago?
Yeah, well, you know what? The most important thing is that conversations are happening, because when we set up She Says, feminism was such an uncool thing. I would literally talk to young female creatives and they'd go, but we don't have a problem. there is no problem. But pay gap, held back, da-da-da-da. No, there's no problem. And then what would happen was women would internalize it and go, well, I haven't succeeded or I've not progressed or what have you. It's because I'm not good enough, not because I've got all of these factors out of my control. So the most important thing that's happening in terms of conversation is conversation, actually. It's that people have, men and women, the industry as a whole has woken up to the fact that things aren't right and are starting to try on a bigger scale to solve some of these problems. And they're not going to be solved overnight. But you've got a lot more male allyship now than, I mean, there was none before. But the most important thing is that women realize that they have a voice and they can speak up.
Okay. Can you give me one new nugget, one new piece of clarity, one new piece of simplicity from all of the conversations that you're involved with She Says? What's one thing that you think I might not have thought of?
I think the one thing that I am driving home to female creatives specifically at the moment is that you need to be pushing for those great briefs and to have your name on the work and to get on those pitches right from day dot. Because if you go, it's okay, I've just started out my career and maybe I'm being overlooked, but I'll have plenty of time in the future. What you don't realize is that every year that you move forwards without those things is a year that you fall behind your male peers. And by the time you get to the point where you are going to make a creative director, which is probably 3 or 4 years later than your male peers, the jump from there to any kind of leadership role creatively is almost impossible unless you've built your career right from the beginning, unless you've really been on top of it, and it's super uncomfortable for some women, and they don't like talking about themselves necessarily, or they do get spoken over, or they do get overlooked, and all of those things. But you need to be in control of your career from the beginning in order to get the outcome that you want at the end. And no amount of hard work by the time you get to creative director is going to tip you over into ECG necessarily, unless you've got that back catalogue of amazing work and profile. So that is my thing. Like, just don't leave it till later. Do it now.
No, I like that. So every year you're not getting ahead is a year you're leaving yourself behind, or it's like you're moving back a year. That's provocative.
Yeah.
Interesting. I like that one. And I think it's more broadly applicable to just people who don't talk up for themselves, regardless of.
Absolutely. It's not just about gender. It's about anyone who feels a little bit out of place or is an introvert or whatever it is, comes from a different place or has a different energy. You've got to put yourself out there.
Oh, that's so good, so good. Have you written a book? I hope you write a book.
I have written a book.
Okay.
It's called Creative Superpowers.
Oh, yeah. I know that.
Yeah.
I meant like a Laura book. That was like other people as well, right?
Yeah, that was other people as well. I am in the process of doing something which may end up being a book, actually. So I've written a bunch of books with other people. How Can Make a Teach Thief, Future of Advertising, and then this book about creative superpowers. I'm doing a project at the moment with someone, which we're just starting out on, to try to challenge ourselves, put ourselves in uncomfortable situations, to go out and talk to people who are incredibly creative about what creativity means to them and how they stay creative. They will give us a challenge. We will accept the challenge and do it and document it. And that will, down the line, be a something. It's definitely going to be a podcast. Ooh. But I imagine it's probably going to be some kind of a book at the end.
We should chat. Yeah. Like, I've been wanting to do this thing that I was going to call street strategy for years, where you go out onto the street and act like one of the street magicians, but you're doing stuff in your head. Maybe there's a way to do a little collab.
We'd be up for that. So I'm doing it with a friend of mine, Ruby, and she's fabulous because she's like super quirky and really introverted and incredibly like poetic and wonderful and into ravens and, you know, gothic dresses. And between the two of us, I think there's going to be some really interesting challenges. We've got one to perform poetry live, which may or may not happen at the Edinburgh Festival. Don't know yet, because that's very soon. But certainly over the next couple of months, like, watch this space, because we're going to be doing that. I think it's going to be called Burst, but it's all very early doors.
And with all the things that you have going on, where's the best place for people to find links to this stuff?
Probably the easiest place is Twitter, at Laura, J-A-Y-B-E-E, Laura J-B, or you can check mrpresident.co, not .co.uk, just .co. Mm-hmm. And then I've got my own site up, but it's not very exciting. It's just for, you know, when I'm doing speaking and that kind of thing. So, yeah, they're probably the best two places. Laura JB on Twitter is probably key.
Love it. You got so much going on. That's so good. All right. Well, thank you so much for taking your break from all of that today and spending time.
No whackers.
All right, Laura. Best wishes with everything, and hope to see you in the flesh soon.
You too. By the way, Casper sends his love.
Right back at him.
Yeah. All right. See you later.
Peace.